It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 591 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a special guest in Bill Slavin, who has created Secrets of Jarrow from Renegade Entertainment. He's won more than 30 illustration awards during his long career and created this great whodunit-style murder mystery set in a future ravaged by a climate disaster. The first volume in this epic trilogy has already been released, so we discuss how this book came to be, who the various characters, including Mordecai Crowe, are, and when we can expect the next volumes to be released. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Bill has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show! The Secrets of Jarrow is a great mystery story set in a possible future, a whodunit that moves us through this world through a captivating page-turner. And I'm talking with the creator of The Secrets of Jarrow right now. It's Bill Slavin. And how you doing, Bill?
I'm doing really good, Wayne. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. Let's talk a little bit about you and comics first before we dive into the book itself. First thing I should, people always tell me I don't give the vital statistics as soon as I should. So The Secrets of Jarrow, the first volume of three, came out in mid-May. So it should be available. If it's not available in local shops, I think you can go to Amazon. I think I saw it there.
Yeah, I think it must be online. I have a friend down in Nevada, and he said that he bought his copy last week. So I guess it must be around.
Sure. Okay, very good, very good. So let's talk about you in comics. As I was reading an interview that you had given, you were talking about that you had been into comics when you were younger, but you kind of went on to do other things, and now you're kind of coming back to it. Talk about your experience with comics, if you would.
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. Absolutely. When I was a kid, you know, I loved comics. Not so much. I mean, there were the superhero comics and that in my life, and they were around. I never had a big collection. My good friend had a much bigger collection. But sometime early on, I had a brother and sister-in-law who had been in England. They came back with an Asterix comic, and that started a lifelong love affair with the Asterix comics, Asterix and Obelix. It's a, for those of your listeners who don't know, it's I'm sure they probably do, but it's a French comic, I guess. French, Belgium. I think Gosney was Belgium. Anyways, so that just opened up other doors for me. I loved those comics, and I devoured them, and I purchased every new volume as it came out. And so that was really my life with comics as a kid, and just wanting to draw comics, and I just loved the whole idea of them. And that's sort of a When I was coming of age, that, you know, there wasn't much. I'm in Canada. I live in Canada, in Ontario, and there wasn't much of a comic industry outside of the superhero comic industry at that time. And so I sort of just with my art, I drifted in other directions. Graphic storytelling still, but more in the direction of doing kids' books. So I spent a good chunk of my life doing kids' books, and that was great. Loved doing them. Fantastic. But eventually I got to the point where I had the time and space and inclination and went back to a first love. And that was maybe about 10 years ago or so. I started doing a little bit before that, but started doing a lot more graphic novels. And now that's what I do. I'm doing comics and having the time of my life, I got to tell you, just loving it. Hugely.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting because I think everybody, when you get to be a teenager, comics aren't cool anymore. And people kind of say, oh, I used to read those, but not anymore. I'm adult now. Yeah. And so I don't do those things. I mean, that's when I grew up, I wandered away from them. I had a twin brother, and my brother never left them. He always read comics and stuff. So I came back to them later on. when the new Teen Titans came out, I got back into it by then. I bought a couple, and then about a couple more, and now I make the weekly trip to the comic shop.
It's great. Yeah, it's nice to revisit some of those things. I think I'm kind of been in a stage in my life for the last little while where I've been revisiting all kinds of things that I loved as a child, and it's a nice place, nice space to be in. I think everybody should do it.
So where did the Mordecai, Mordecai Crowe books come from? Were you doing a version of those before the comics came in, or was this a part of your comics return?
No, it was part of my comics return, I guess. Quite a while ago now, about 13 years ago, 14 years ago, I was playing around with the idea of Mordecai Crowe, but I was still pretty busy with other work at the time, and a lot of my book work still. And when I say book work, I mean children's book illustration and writing. And so I really liked the idea, tootled around with it a little bit, did a few sample pages and kind of sketched out some plot lines and stuff, but then put it on the back burner for a long time. And in the interim, did another graphic novel trilogy, this one for kids called Elephants Never Forget. And enjoyed doing that a lot, but then came back to Mordecai Crowe maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and then just really started to dedicate my life to getting that comic out there. Yeah.
So how did you get involved with Renegade Entertainment? Did you meet people from there? How did you do that?
The way that happened, and it was fairly serendipitous, but when I started doing Mordecai Crowe, I'd finished the first volume and was on my way into the second, and I just was really having a lot of fun doing the book. But any of my my contacts, my world really again was children's book publishing, so I wasn't too cued into the world of comic books, which is a whole other world, quite honestly. The two, there's not a lot of intersection between the two. And so I didn't know where to go with it. Now, quite frankly, and as much as I love drawing comics, I hate the self-promotion and the and looking for a publisher part of it. So every time I did that, it just sapped all my energy. And I would put that aside, and then I'd get all excited about doing my book again. And so I just kind of kept doing my book. So to get back to Renegade, but every once in a while I thought, you know what, I really, really do want to get this book published and like to find the right people. And so I did some research on the internet and was looking at various comic book publishers, and I came across this company called Renegade. And I was attracted to them for a couple of reasons. One, they were Canadian, and that was great because I'm Canadian, and it's kind of nice to publish with somebody from my own country. But the other thing was, they had a really eclectic, book list. It seemed like so much of the comic industry is pretty genre oriented, whereas I was looking at Renegade's book list, and it was just great. It was just all over the place, and it seemed like their priority was publishing good stories and making them happen. So I sent it off and forgot about it for a couple of months. Maybe 3 months, and then I got a call from Renegade, and they said they wanted to publish it, and I was over the moon. It was great.
Cool. I've been interacting with Renegade over the years, and they one time they get a book that was about the history of Canada, which as an American I didn't know much about, and so I really learned a lot reading that comic about that, the whole history of Canada. I didn't understand the holidays. And the way things go, because I used to live in Pennsylvania, but now I live in Florida, so I'm even farther away from any contact with Canada. But I was so intrigued by all the stuff I didn't know, and so I got to interview the creator, and it was so fascinating to me because I love things I don't know anything about. I have to be honest with you. You talked about French. I love European graphic novels because their method of storytelling is so different from American storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I recently read a book about monsters that just, when I started to read it, I could not put it down. It was just amazing just wonderful stuff. And it was so different from American books that I just really loved it. I said, I got to get this. So I got every book that I could find in the series, and I read through them all, and I, to this day, I keep my eye open. I think I'm doing any more of that. That was really, really good, because I'm not a monster guy. See, that's the thing that gets me. I don't like monster stuff, so it's called Carthago.
Okay.
And the initial book has a huge, huge shark, and if you look really closely, there's a little girl. And it's actually a preteen swimming right in front of this shark. And when I realized what that was, I went, gasp, oh my gosh, how can she survive in front of that shark? And so to me, that was a European book that had been translated into American English.
Yeah.
And somebody referred me to it. And the moment I hit it, I was just transfixed. I loved it so much. So see, that's the thing I like about what I've read of your book has really been intriguing as well. Something important we need to talk about, because I think this is something that in the comics industry, there are writers, there are artists, there's letterers, and you name it. There's all kinds of people involved in the process. But my understanding is that when it comes particularly to the Secrets of Jarrow, you're doing basically the whole thing. You do the writing and the art. Are you doing the lettering as well?
Yeah, I am, with a little bit of coaching from Alexander at Renegade, because turns out I knew knew nothing about comic book lettering. So not hand lettering for sure. It's a typeface, of course. But yeah, he gave me a book on lettering. That was great. So you know, I've been learning loads, and that was really an interesting education for me. But absolutely, yeah, the writing, the tonal work, it's kind of monochromatic, not really monochromatic, but you know, duotones, my book and all the artwork, that's all me for sure.
I always find that interesting, because I always have to ask people who do that. Are you an artist who writes? Are you a writer who draws? And most people just say, I'm just a storyteller. I'd like to do it all. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
I would say that I am an artist who writes. I would say I'm coming at it from the art perspective, but I do love the storytelling and I've enjoyed that part of it. I read a lot. I love stories and I love storytelling and I've always said I'm a visual storyteller. So I think what I mean by that is that there's different kinds of storytelling. And as you say, writers, author, or illustrators, that's what they're doing. They're all just doing different sorts of storytelling. And the thing that I like about comic books is I love the fact that all that storytelling all kind of comes together in one place, you know, and I'm mm-hmm. able to do both those things. And that just, man, you know, it's the best feeling in the world. Like I mean that sincerely. I just love living in that world all day. You know, the drawing, the writing, but the drawing especially. When I get into the drawing, the inking, I just love inking. You know, so I don't know. There's none of it that I don't like. Yeah.
See, that's the thing that's really good. I think when somebody's a creator, they want to get into those kinds of things, and I think it's really great that. That people can do all those aspects. Because let me tell you, there are some writers you do not want them to draw. be very honest. And there's some artists who couldn't write worth their to save themselves. So I when somebody can do all that, I think that's a rare and wonderful talent. So I have to congratulate you on that.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's a real gift to be able to have the opportunity to do it. Because, you know, again, I spent most of my life illustrating books. I wrote a few, but mostly I illustrated. And so I was always responding to other people's ideas, you know, and that was great. But it's another whole world. And you can just, only be responsible to your own vision. That's been a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and I talked a little bit before we started to record. I was reading one of your interviews, and you said something that intrigued me, because you talked a little bit about the fact that when you read a comic, you tend to focus on the artwork mm-hmm. as opposed to what the story is. And I found that fascinating, because you're both a writer and an artist. But I was telling you, I was part of a little group that was studying music, and we were talking about the fact that some people like the words in the song, and they focus on that, and they don't hear the melody hardly at all. Other people focus on the melody and the music and don't know what the song is about. They just happen to like the music. And there's other people who can do both or listen to both. So there's all kinds of, you know, I always look at things in terms of spectrums. There's this huge spectrum where people fall. And I think that's true with comics too. And I read where you mentioned that the art seems to be the most important part. I don't think that means that you don't appreciate the story or the words and the writing and stuff like that, but that's kind of your initial primary focus. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think, you know, I've always been first an artist and secondly, a storyteller. I've devoted my life to it. So, you know, you put drawings in front of me, you put artwork in front of me, and I'm going to be looking at that. I'm going to be thinking, wow, how'd that guy do that, you know, and trying to figure it out and just admiring what they've done, or just saying, oh, like I could never do this in a million years, but I'm loving it, you know? And, and so in that respect, yeah, that's the way it grabs me first and foremost. It's going to be the art that grabs me. But I've been reading, you know, many comics, and if the story hasn't got me as well, no matter how good the art is, I might not even get through that comic, you know. So I guess it, you know, both are super important, but it's always the art where it all begins, and with my own comics, it's where the art it starts with the art as well. It's in all honesty, I'm kind of thinking of visual ideas before I get into the storyline itself. Curious enough. Yeah.
Well, I always like to say that the cover is what draws people in to buy the comic. It's the story that has them come back for more.
Yeah.
Right? That's the way I look at how comics sell and things like that. And a lot of people tell me that's kind of the way it goes. You don't have a good cover, you're in real trouble, because people may not pick up the book, but you want them to do that. So that's always important.
Yeah, covers are tough. I've done a lot of covers. not comic book covers, but book covers. And you're right. Yeah, the cover is a tough gig.
Well, that's where it's helpful to be an artist.
To
get the cover. At least you might have a pukey story, but if you've got a good cover, you can at least get them to look at it and start to get so.
Yeah, I get
you. But see, you as an artist, you have an advantage in that you can make a cover better than a writer ever could do. So that's a good thing.
Yeah, and it's got to be tough being a writer, because, you know, I think too sometimes, because you put it all out there and you write this beautiful story, and then if the artist lets you down, you know, that can't be an easy thing either. And I've known writers in my lifetime to you know, that said that exact thing, you know, that.
But see, if you're a writer, you can write "the building exploded" and it's going to be a whole page, and then the artist gets it and it's, you know, he wrote a whole sentence, and the artist has to draw the whole page full of the building exploding. That's not going to take that's going to take a lot longer than it took the writer to do.
I did a series of historical-based graphic novels when I was a kid. When I was doing kids' books, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago. And I often tease the writer, because she wrote one line. She goes, "Thousands of people are watching the game, you know?" And I'm like, "Thousands of people? Are you nuts, you know? Do you have any idea what you just made me have to do, you know?" Even at the very minimum, it's 1,000 tiny little circles that kind of vaguely look like people. But, you know, still, you know, how dare you, you know?
That's where it's good if there's a working together of the artist and the writer, because a lot of times writers will go to artists and say, "What do you like to draw?" And they'll fashion the story on what the guy likes to draw. So I find that interesting too. It's a good way to.
That's super smart. Yeah.
That's a good way to do it. So let's get the secret to Gerald, because this is the first of 3 volumes, my understanding is.
Right.
And let me read this a brief description. It says, "The secrets of the past have been lost. Knowledge is forbidden. The climate has run wild, and civilization has devolved into post-technological anarchy. In the midst of this wasteland, Mordecai Crowe, a A drifter in search of his long-lost parents becomes embroiled in a murderous conspiracy when he seeks refuge in a fortress committed to preserving ancient knowledge. What secrets lie at the heart of its ancient walls, and how are they connected to Mordecai's mysterious past? And so that's the beginning, the whole business with describing the first volume. How many pages are in the first book?
Oh, golly. Let me look. No, I think it's around 120, the first volume. I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Is that going to be consistent moving forward? This one's going to be about 120.
Second one, I can tell you, is yeah, it's going to be about the same. Third one, no, it's going to take a little bit longer to wrap all this up. So okay. I think probably the third volume is going to be reaching more towards 150, 160 pages.
Okay. Are you going to, and I don't mean to diminish sales on the first one, but are you thinking about possibly collecting all these into one big volume after you get the whole story told?
Jeez, I'm not even there, Wayne, yet. No, that would be like, yeah, that would be super fantastic. And yet, as you know, that's going to be a publishing decision, not my decision. But if Alexander's listening to this or when he hears it, yes, please, please. Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah. Yeah, see, I love like, those compilations. Yeah.
So do I. See, I like a big book where I can sit down and pour my head into it. I was talking about that Carthago. It mm-hmm. must have been about 500 pages, that first volume. Wow. And I could not put it down. You know, I was hours into that, living in that world, you know, with Bigfoot and huge sharks and all this other stuff. And it was done very realistically. That was the thing that really got me. And so I felt like I was there, you know. I was,
yeah.
So with your book, you pulled me into that world as well. Now, I've got it because I'm a story guy. I got to know, Mordecai Crowe, is he based on somebody you know? Is he like an aspect of yourself? Where did the character come from?
Where'd the character come from? These are the sort of questions I actually should know the answer to before you ask me. he came from, I think I just, I needed, I wanted to have my protagonist be a young protagonist first and foremost, you know? So I was thinking along those lines. I wanted to be an outsider. So that was another big part of Mordecai's development. He's one of these. He's a guy that's living between two worlds. When you get into the book, it's pretty obvious pretty soon. But there's sort of these two major factions. You know, a faction that sees the way forward after the collapse of society. With looking at that way forward as being to try to regain the lost knowledge that had been lost, especially, you know, because of the technological meltdown, just everything was lost and turned out people were just complete crap at doing anything because they'd just forgotten how to do it. So there's that, you know, so there's that world. Those guys are the Gnostics. But then on the other side, there's these other guys, and their way forward after the collapse is to completely reject all technology, to basically go back to much earlier time in human history and use that as their kind of golden age that they're trying to recreate. So clearly diametrically opposed, you know, views of the world. And then we have Mordecai, and Mordecai's kind of there in the middle between those two worlds. So that's kind of where his character came from. So I sort of saw him as maybe someone who's maybe just a little bit not too committed, not an ideologue, you know. He's just a guy trying to survive and pursuing his own quest and within this
see what
collapse world. Yeah.
What gets me is that when he's surprised, he yells out a funny phrase. He yells out, "Holy motherboard," at one point. And I was just, I had to laugh when I saw that because this is post-computer era. And yeah. So when he knows enough about technology to use expressions that we would understand. And I got a huge kick out of that, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. He's pretty tech savvy. That's his thing. He's not a Gnostic, but he's kind of one of these guys that, to a large degree, the Gnostics are his bread and butter because he scavenges old tech, lost tech, you know, finds it in, I don't know, landfills, you know, people's abandoned garage, I don't know, wherever. And so that's his gig. He finds this stuff and then peddles it. Obviously not to the Luddites, because they would have them strung up, but to the Gnostics. Uh-huh.
About, I think he calls some people low-techs.
Low-techs.
Those are people who are not interested in technology, I think, like that. What's the difference between a low-tech and a Luddite?
Well, the Luddites are way more organized. The low-techs are kind of like zombies without the zombie part, I think. They're to my mind, they're just people that have continued to survive on the detritus of the past civilization, you know, but haven't really got it together to come up with any sort of organized response to the world that they now have to survive in. But yeah, cannibalistic. Yeah, they're not nice guys. Low-techs are my favorite, actually. I was drawing some low-techs today, and I realized I want to do a whole book about the low-techs because it's the most fun to draw. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why.
That's funny, because now let's talk about the art part. And who does Mordecai Crowe resemble visually? Does he look like a young you? Is he somebody else that you're patterning him after?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. Someone picked up on this too, and it is true. But when I was kind of searching around for who Mordecai was going to look like, I fashioned him after. I don't have any kids myself, but I have lots of nieces and nephews, and I have one nephew in particular who, super fond of. We've got lots in common, and so if you look at Mordecai, I don't even know if he knows that, but Mordecai looks a bit like him. Yeah.
Interesting. Now, what about some of the other characters? Because you've got Sister Veritas,
yes,
and Sister Trotula, I think one
that's
of those
right.
Called.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Just other ones that we come along as we move through the. He's in a castle of sorts, and so there's a society living in there and stuff like that. And so, are they based on people, or are they kind of creatures of your imagination? Where do these other characters come from?
I'd say most of them are creatures of my imagination. You know, I wanted the characters that inhabited this. It's called a firewall. And basically, it's not a castle, but a bit of an abandoned monastery. But well, at one time, it would have been a monastery. But I would just wanted them to be real characters. I want almost monkish, like, you know, in a parody sort of way, you know, where they're all just have their own quirks and their personalities. So mostly they are products of my imagination, I would say. There's probably one character that ends up, yeah, I always say was one of the first people that I ever did a caricature of was my father. And yeah, kind of big ears, big nose. I don't know, whatever. It wasn't very flattering. And then over the years, I began to realize that this character kept showing up in my stories. And then one day I looked in the mirror and turned out that it wasn't my father, it was me.
Ooh.
Ooh. And there's at least one character that I think my wife keeps telling me has more than a passing resemblance to myself. But again, probably not intentional. That's just the way it worked out.
That's funny, because see, I find this really interesting, because I always tell the story. Very first interview I ever did was with David Peterson, who does Mouse Guard. And I was so convinced that these mice were because they could stand up on their hind legs and carry swords and stuff. I thought they were based on Arthur's Round Table characters. And when I asked him, I said, "Are that who they're based on?" "Oh no," he said, "they're based on me and my friends." Oh, I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, because I know how my friends would react, and now I know their personality, so I know what they're going to do because they're based on my friends and how they're going to function." And so from that day to this, I'm always like, well, where did you base them on? Because I was so stunned by that. I was so convinced they were King Arthur characters.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. That's enough. Yeah. And I think that does happen. You know, when I say that in terms of the characters themselves, are they based on people? Yeah. You know, every once in a while I'm looking at a character and I really wasn't conscious that it was based on anybody. But then by the time I get to the end of the book, I go, you know what? Everything this guy does is the same as what so-and-so would do under the same circumstances. And so I mean, I think that is just always happening. It's just probably happening
it makes it more real.
Level. Yeah.
Yeah. They're more like a real person.
Real person. Yeah. If you have someone in mind, that's great. Yeah.
That kind of helps. Now, let's talk a little bit about the coloring, because you talked about being duotone.
Yeah.
Parts of it are like brown and black, and then other parts are blue and black. And, you know, when he's outside, the outside, of course, there's snow going on in the middle of summer, which is a telling thing, I suppose. And it's blue. Then once he gets inside, it tends to get brown until he moves back outside again, and it's blue again. So are those the main colors you're going to use when you do things? When it's inside, it's largely brown and black, but then outside is blue and black?
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm working with. There's some gray-green in there, too. So that's sort of when they're outside and it's more sunny and not. And then there's a slightly different tone when it's nighttime. But I love black and white work. But the line work wasn't going to necessarily carry this story. So I actually decided to go with a monochromatic approach to it. And that sort of morphed into these duotones. And so, each color is kind of, indicating where the character is and just giving a little bit of that variety. And so that's not too much of the same, but I just love monochromatic work. I didn't do hardly a single piece of colored artwork until I was, into my 30s. And then I did a lot, and I've done a lot of color work, but my first choice is always to go back to black and white. I'm really happy with that choice. I think it really suits the mood of this story for sure. Mm-hmm.
And it also lets your imagination kind of pick up and it pulls you in, and you kind of in your head put in the colors that aren't there or that you think would be there.
I'm glad to hear that. I would hope that would happen, because I know people love color work and probably even I think it was one of the first questions Renegade asked me when they said that they wanted to publish my book. Why not color? I don't really like color, So I'm glad that you're kind of filling in the color. And I think that makes sense. That's what we do, right? We do fill in the pieces all the time. And mm-hmm. I mean, when you read a book, you don't have the pictures, but the pictures play out in your head, obviously. And I mean, not if it's not a graphic novel. So that's great. Yeah. Fill in the colors. Absolutely. I'd love to see. It'd be great to crawl into people's heads and just see how they're deciding to color my work for me.
Because it's interesting to me because the outside makes me feel colder because it's blue. There's a book called Winter World. Mm-hmm. And whenever I read it, I had to put a sweater on because it was – everything was cold, snow everywhere, everybody wearing winter clothes and stuff. Even in Florida, where I lived, I had to put a sweater on because I felt cold. And I get that kind of a thing. It's not that cold, but I do get a sense of cool when he's outside. So, of course, they're wearing coats and jackets and head garments and stuff like that. So I find that helps.
Yeah, always. Again, I'm always like halfway through the book and I'm saying, well, why are these guys wearing like scarves and hats and stuff? Especially because, as you know, the book kind of set in the future with your global warming is kind of a problem, climate change, but, warming of the earth overall. And sometimes it's really hot, but I just love coats and hats and scarves. Must be because I'm Canadian,
Yeah, it is cooler up there. I've been to Canada once. I was to Toronto. Yeah. And luckily it was the summer when I was there. But I see stuff up there on the TV and I go, oh boy, it's cold up there. See, that's why I live in Florida. If I put on a sweater, it goes below freezing maybe once a year. And let me tell you, the TV people go nuts. It's cold out there tonight. You're going to have to put a coat on, kind of stuff. And I kind of smile because, I half the year I used to have to put a coat on. So I find that kind of entertaining.
Pennsylvania, night. Right?
Yeah. One whole night a year, we got to put a coat on and they're freaking out. And I just find that funny. I
used to. Yeah. But it's all good. Bloody hot here now.
Now, of course, now we're in the summer, so the good things are happening out there. Now, there's one thing I enjoyed about the story. You do a very great mystery trope that I love to see. Is Mordecai can't sleep.
Yeah.
And so he decides to go up and walk around, which, of course, is a great thing to do when you can't sleep, kind of burn some calories and some energy. And what does he come across? But he comes across two people having an important conversation outside. And that sets up a lot of what we're going to see moving forward, I'm sure. Talk about that, because he's got good hearing, because where he's standing, he can hear them.
Yeah,
they're kind of a good distance away, so his hearing must be really good. And we get to hear them talking about some of the people there, and it's really an interesting that very brief conversation. But boy, it sets up a lot of what's going on here in my head. So I thought that was really nicely written.
Great. Well, thank you. Yeah, and that also in that panel, you'll notice that's probably the only hand lettering I did, the part where he doesn't hear them right at first. And so I use the ultra sort of illegible kind of Greek script in there. But, but yeah, I like that scene a lot. I like the night scenes in general. I think partly just because of the mood that they create. And again, you know, I'm going back to the visual here, but I love the strong shadows and the blacks and whites. And especially when you get into the night scenes, you get all kinds of good excuses to be doing that kind of drawing. But it did work out really well that he just wasn't able to sleep and was able to be there at that point. And again, it's one of those things, I think, and you'll hear this from writers all the time, but where the story just kind of leads you along, and then that's just kind of the way that it turns out. I'd already decided that he was a little bit that he suffered from claustrophobia, and so just has real trouble sleeping under roofs, you know, and so that already gave him a good excuse to be get out of bed, and because they put him in a cramped little cell, and he just had to go and find someplace else to sleep at that point. That's what put him out, and then as you say, he had the chance to overhear this conversation that really becomes fairly pivotal as the story progresses.
Yeah. Well, then of course he ends up going inside of a I don't know if it looks like it's a library of sorts and like tech archives.
Yeah, tech archives.
And he goes, and that's where he sits holding motherboard, and he. And that they have another conversation, and he happens to have something that works with the technology they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's where the preview that I got to read ends. So now I'm like, what is it? What's going to happen? So I got to give the whole of the book, because I'm curious to know what technology it is and what's happening. Is it like a videotape? Is it a cassette tape?
Did you recognize it?
I thought it was a cassette tape, but it could be a videotape.
So it's a thing called a jazz drive. And some of your older listeners might remember these, but before CDs, you know, before DVDs, all of this stuff, before jump drives and all the rest, people were scrambling to figure out ways to create new technologies that would hold more information. And so essentially, it was almost like a cassette, the jazz drive. And I owned one, you know, had one briefly. It's just one of the many pieces of technology that just got shuffled off to the landfill after I'd spent gross amounts of money to purchase in the first place.
But, I'm always interested because, you know, as technology has advanced, I have found things I really invested in disappear. I used to have plastic albums.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden one day I go to the record store and there's no records. It's all CDs. And I said, but I don't have a CD player. We're going to have to buy one.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with all the records? I got all these records. I can't play them anymore. And if I ever go to a CD player.
Yeah.
So it's
have this problem, you know, like the wheel 600 years ago was still pretty handy to 400 years later, right?
Yeah. I remember throwing all my records out at one point, and I'm still on a quest to replace them all with digital music and stuff like that.
So and then, of course, the whole move back to vinyl, too, you know, goes around, comes around. And that's kind of where the tech archives come into in the book, too, you know. Mm-hmm. There's all this old stuff. And, you know, I mean, would there be that much old stuff still kicking around 100 years later? I mean, who the heck knows? Probably not. But people do hang on to that. I have a local guy who runs a tech shop, and I just, you know, I get my computer fixed there. He's great. He knows everything. Mm-hmm. And but I was back in his place, and just in his back room, he just had piles and piles of disemboweled technology, you know, on his shelves. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, I'm doing this book. I got to come in here and photograph your shop, because this is exactly the feel that I want in the in the archives of Jero, you know.
I so remember the funniest. I had the funniest experience one time. I was going to buy. What kind of a thing was it? It wasn't a floppy, but it was like a thing after the floppy. Mm-hmm. And I went there, and who are in the place, work in the place, but like Mennonites. And they've got these old school clothes on all over the place with hair bonnets. And there they are selling high tech stuff. and I just kind of said, you know, this doesn't work for me. I can't. How in the world can you, you know, be that, you know, live like that and then sell high tech stuff to other people? That's just how we do it.
Seems like a bit of a contradiction, quite.
Yeah, well, I was stunned by it. You know, I literally I had a tough time, but they knew as much as they could about it. So I was like, okay, so that makes me your book makes me think of that. So that's kind of interesting.
That's funny. Well, a lot of them do look a bit like Mennonites. It's true.
So the first book is all together now, and it's at what you said, 120 pages. So it's going to be, I got to get my hands on one. If people want to get them, can they go right to Renegade Entertainment, or should they go to Amazon? What's the best place to go and get them?
I think Renegade will sell them directly, and I don't want to say that they shouldn't go to Renegade. That's absolutely a course they can take. But Amazon has it. It's in the, and hopefully it'll be in the bookstores and comic book stores soon as well. I know that Renegade distributes into the States as well as through Canada. So I'm hoping that, people will be able to find this book, wherever they want to find it. Online for sure too.
I miss bookstores. The biggest thing the pandemic did to me was it forced me not to be able to go into bookstores, where I love to go, in libraries and stuff like that, because I used to love to rummage around in there and find stuff.
I was in a bookstore today. It was a real old school used bookstore, and I haven't been in something like that for literally years. You're right, and you just forget what those places are like. It's they're like a treasure trove, you know, but overwhelming too. There's just so much stuff. And of course, well, what's your filing system? Is it alphabetical? No. Is it by subject matter? Sort of, you know? Yeah. So then, you know, like, you want to find something, you just got to go and you got to look. You got to spend physical time in there. Yeah.
See, that's a problem though. How do you find things that you're looking for?
Yeah. How do you find something new too? Like, how do you stumble on something anymore? You know, if you hear this hot cop podcast, sure, that's great, and that's the way now it's going to happen, not by walking into a bookstore.
So it's a great book. The first book is out now, and the second book is going to be. Do you know when that's going to be finished?
Yeah, I do, because it's finished.
Oh, good.
But it'll be out next spring, I think, is the idea. And the third book will, which I'm working on now, will be out hopefully the spring afterwards. So we're planning to kind of get each volume out without too much of a delay in between, so that people aren't kind of left hanging for forever and ever. And then the compilation one, right, Wayne?
Right. Oh, please. See, that to me sounds really interesting, because I like I said, I love to dive into longer stories and just got lost in there for a while. So I'd love to have a longer edition of these. I think this would be, it'd be so great to get lost. You know, it's interesting because you've done kids books, and I was going to say that you might've gotten out of kids books too, right at the wrong time, because children's books now are huge. They are, like, if I go into the Target locally here or Walmart, they've got a whole section full of kids' books and stuff like that. And you might want to get this into a kids' book section or something if you can.
Well, you know, and maybe it'll end up there. You know, it's funny when you do a story. I mean, I guess maybe most writers are probably a little bit more savvy and know who they're writing for and who their market is. But, you know, I did, mine was a market of one, and that was me that I was doing the book for. Mm-hmm. And I really had always seen it as a book for adults and still do, but because of the content, my publisher says he's put it at like 10 and up. So, that sort of makes sense. I've been kind of in a state of arrested adolescence for most of my life. So I probably did write it for a 10-year-old after all. I just didn't know it, you know. But anyway, so hopefully some kids will find it too. I think they would like it.
Yeah. That's interesting because it reads like very grippingly, and I think people are going to really enjoy it. And again, it's called The Secrets of Jarrow, and it's from Renegade Entertainment. And if you can't find it in your local store and they're not able to order it themselves, you can go to Renegade Entertainment. I think it's renegadeentertainment.com, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. or to Amazon, and you'll be able to get it there. So I guess the way you're talking, this is keeping you busy right now. There aren't other projects you're really working on besides this one.
This is it. Absolutely. Yeah. This is what I get up and do every day. And the only other project I'm working on is the one that kind of rattles around my head, because I realize that when I'm done the third book, I'm having way too much fun doing this, and I better have another project in mind, because I'll go stir crazy if I don't have something else to put on my drawing table.
Oh. Yeah. Are you going to have anything more in the Mordecai Crow universe? Is that what you think, or are you going to go somewhere else?
Maybe somewhere else. Yeah. Right at the moment, it's somewhere else. But, you know, again, it might be, yeah, it might be something I have to think about. There are some parts of the universe that I absolutely would love to revisit as well. So that all just remains to be seen. Yeah.
Because I always respect world building. The cheapest thing in the world to me, and this will reflect which company I'm talking about, is the city of New York should have been rebuilt 5 times over. All the stuff that goes on in there. And so to me, I like to see someplace I'd never been before. Let's go somewhere I haven't been. And that's one of the things about your book that I really enjoy. I like going places I haven't been before. So I really enjoy that about the book.
Thank you. Yeah, I do too. And I don't want, in fact, I'll say a big part of my visual inspiration, I travel a lot. I travel a lot in Europe, actually. My wife and I travel there, and I love going places where nobody else has gone. And a lot of those places end up in my book because just visually, they've been a real inspiration for me. That and the history that I see when I travel, it all kind of comes back into the story. So yeah, I totally get that. I love traveling places I've never been before physically, and then in my own imagination too. Yeah, when I sit down at my work.
Well, I used to work for a newspaper of note, and I won't say where, but the one they were constantly getting books and novels and stuff for free because people wanted them to review them. And if they didn't review them or stuff, they would make them available to employees. And my mom was a voracious reader. And so I used to go and I'd pick up all the books I thought she would normally read. And when I would go up to see her once a month, I would take those books up there and she would just get lost in them. You know, she would read them day and day and said, "Oh, I like this book where this and this and this happened." And I said, "Mom, I hate to tell you, I never read it. I just brought it for you." But she would sit there and she enjoyed television well enough, but she liked to read. And so she would sit there by the hour reading these books I would bring her and stuff.
Wow, what a gift.
The bad news was her house was full of books.
Yeah.
So we had to figure out how to dispose of them when the time came. But that was, she loved them. I was always grateful to bring those up there. I was glad they provide them for free. I would never have been able to afford all those books, but
Well, that's where you rediscover your library, because you can read it and then take it back again, right?
Yeah. That's right. Okay, yeah. So The Secrets of Jarrow, those are going to be coming out. Are you involved with social media at all? How can we follow you on social media?
A little bit. So John there kicking and screaming. No, it's not true at all. But I do have a website, billslavin.com. And I'm blogging about Mordecai Crow there. And Mordecai Crow also has his own Facebook page, so you can find me there. And that's about it. Yeah, no Twitter account.
Mm-hmm.
No Instagram.
What about conventions? Are you going to be doing conventions at all this summer?
Not that I know of, Wayne. It would be a trip. I did the Toronto Comic Arts Festival convention just recently, the indie convention that's held in Toronto every year, and that was a lot of fun. But beyond that, I think probably not. I certainly, it's not in the cards right now.
Well, yeah. It's not for everybody. I happen to really enjoy conventions. I'm hoping to get to New York Comic Con, which is my favorite. I want to go there.
No, they're amazing, amazing place. Not that I don't even enjoy them. It's just, you know, I've got a garden.
I always like to say real life gets in the way of comics sometimes. Yeah. And so you have to kind of do those things.
No, it's all good.
Well, Bill, it's been good talking with you. And this is going to be a great book, a fun series. I can't wait until the collected edition comes out, Alexander. And we want to be able to get these because I'm going to be after this book now trying to get a hold of it and enjoy reading after page 26, which looks really great to do. So, Bill, I think you're onto something great here. I think this is the beginning of good stuff for you in comics, and I just hope I get to read a lot more from you in the future. And maybe when the next series comes out, we can talk again and we can promote your good work at that point.
Hey, Wayne, thanks for this. Really appreciate your time, and it's been super big pleasure just to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.